Welcome back. It's the Friday Politics. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling, who's away in his Holly Halls this week. Martin Summers is in the studio with me. Martin, welcome along.
Hello there.
I'm going to do a quick travel update, and then we're going to take 3 minutes to kind of digest what we gleaned from Mark Wright in the first hour of the show. Reports M32 outbound. There's reports of an accident between Junction 3 for the A4320 Eastern Way and the A4032 Newfoundland Way with the B4015 Lower Ashley Road and Mill Pond Road, Minor Road. Traffic is coping well, apparently, but avoid if you can. Also, very slow traffic on Brentry Hill inbound at Henbury. One lane closed due to an accident on the A4018 at Crow Lane and Knoll Road at the Old Crow Roundabout next to the pub there. Wraxall, bit of problem on Clevedon Road in both directions in Somerset. Very slow traffic due to an accident between Portbury Lane at Wraxall and Oxhouse Lane at Failand. And the last update we've got, actually, that's the same one, Bedminster. We've got A38 Bedminster Parade, heavy traffic near Phillip Street for the Asda Superstore. That's just been updated. And actually, on London Road over towards Bath, very, very slow on the A46 to and from the centre of Bath. That is your traffic update from Inrix. Weather. It's chilly. It's going to get worse. It's going to tip rain all day tomorrow. And then Sunday is a nice day if cold. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, wintry showers interspersed with moments of brightness, but largely wrap up warm. Martin Summers, welcome to the studio again. Mark Wright. So we had him for an hour. What have we learned?
Well, I mean, you learned, but you know, he's a very serious guy who's been involved in running his ward for years, and you were asking him lots of very nitty gritty questions.
Well, he
did his best to answer.
It is Bristol's shop window, I think, his ward. And I'm not certain I have to praise him for his custodianship of that ward.
Well, no, I mean, you asked him difficult questions about things that have been going on in the ward, but I mean, that kind of level of close, questioning of nitty-gritty stuff, I mean, that's very valuable, because often what we do on the show is we're making general points about general stuff, and, you were very much chasing down the local aspect of who he was and what he'd been doing.
And why he's allowed the city to become slightly less good than it was.
Well, I mean, I think the fact is that local councillors actually don't have a great deal of power, and things happen which they're not able to stop it. I mean, as he said, I tried to oppose various things that you weren't happy with, but I just didn't win, you know.
You say I wasn't happy, and to an extent I am frustrated by them, but a lot of people are unhappy with the way things have gone, I think. That's not me masquerading as Vox Populi. No. I think it could have been handled much better, and I'm not the only one who thinks that.
Well, I mean, the council is, you know, the reputation of the council is, let's say, mixed in the city. It's not regarded as, you know, it's not one of those institutions that people immediately say, oh, wow, what a fantastic institution. And of course, we've had all the stuff of having a mayor or not having a mayor, and then having one, and then having another one. It's not even clear that the majority of people in Bristol want a mayor.
Well, I was going to ask, can we undo this?
Because apparently we can. I mean, I believe that the Liberal Democrats, via Lady Barbara, whatever her name is, Jank, are pushing for us. For the possibility of having the possibility of a referendum to get rid of the mayor, because in fact in other cities it's already part of the setup that you can get rid of the mayor if you don't like having mayors anymore. Like, I think they got rid of the one in Doncaster, you know, where the guy who dressed as a monkey got elected as the mayor, and then eventually they got fed up with it and went back to the old system.
Okay, because, you know, it was the Lib Dems who pushed this through. It was their custodianship.
Well, no, it was pushed through by in fact, Barbara Yank and others opposed to having a mayor, and as you heard earlier, Mike Wright doesn't want a mayor, and Gary Hopkins hates the whole concept of mayors, and he's the leader of the Lib Dems on the council, so they've never been much in favour of mayors, in fact.
Okay.
as I'm not.
Yes, well, you know, it's difficult. I can't honestly see a swift passage back to power for the Lib Dems locally or nationally in this country.
No. But they're going to be around, and they're going to carry on, being a force. They're not going to disappear completely.
I understand that, but Mark isn't here, obviously, to defend his party's position. But I do feel that their deportment through the coalition and during their custodianship of Bristol City Council for the decade of the noughties has removed their privileged position of being the party of dissent. If you wanted to cast a vote against something, one would have voted for the Liberal Democrats until quite recently.
I think they're really silly to go into coalition with the Conservatives. That was absolutely suicidal for them. And essentially, when Nick Clegg was just been elected and was just becoming Deputy Prime Minister, I interviewed him for this programme, and I said, "You're going to lose the country's AAA credit rating." And one of the longest questions ever on, which was mocked by the managers here. But the purpose of me asking the question in such a long way was to make sure he couldn't get out of answering the question. And of course, sure enough, they did lose the country's AAA credit rating by going along with the Tories' austerity policy.
Yes.
Which of course completely undermines the whole purpose of having, an austerity policy is to keep your credit rating. So you have an austerity policy and lose the credit rating. There's no benefit to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Liberals should never have gone along with that. They should have been a minority Tory government, and they should have tried to get their stuff through, and everybody else vote it down.
Well, they now are a minority Tory government.
Well, yes,
thanks
so we've got there.
Theresa May's genius. Again, unelected, the least worst candidate for the job gets the job again. You mentioned austerity not working. Let's talk about this, because a lot of the questions I was posing to Mark Wright during the first hour of this evening's broadcast, he was saying, well, the money from central government is gone. There's no money from central government. Mm. These are all austerity flavoured cuts that have been made. But, you know, it was Labour that bankrupted everybody. And now it's Labour in power in Bristol saying, yeah, but there's no money for anything. And you've got Labour MPs, five of them, I think, for Bristol now, still saying, yeah, but there's no money for anything.
Well, I mean, the money went because of the collapse of the financial services sector. And of course, what the Labour Party had done with Brown and Blair was essentially allow the City of London to run its own show its own way without any attempt to try and discipline them. And in fact, that is the historic task of the Labour movement in general, is to discipline the City of London. And they didn't do it. And then when it collapsed, they were then left with the consequences.
Martin, you're being quite generous with that. Not only did they not do it, they actively deregulated it beyond what Thatcher had done.
Yeah, well, basically the same thing happened with Clinton in the US, where he pushed through the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated investment banking from retail banking since the 1930s. And of course, it was regarded at that era as a sign of being modern and progressive to follow through on this kind of neoliberal financial services sector agenda. Mm-hmm. And it was wrong at the time, and it was subsequently shown to be very wrong. And that's why there's been a kind of reaction within the grassroots in the Labour Party against that kind of policy. Although you see John McDonnell was in Davos last week, you know, schmoozing with the billionaires.
Well, presumably he's a man who sings from the same hymn sheet as you, being a staunch left old Labour economist.
That's right.
So he doesn't appear to be coming up with many credible or workable solutions.
Well, he would obviously disagree with that. I mean, it's not just him. There are quite a lot of people like Ann Pettifer, Simon Wren-Lewis, Steve Keane. These are all academic economists who are, you know, in the mix of, and the tax justice guy, Richard Murphy. There's lots of stuff being talked about what the policy is going to be when they come to power. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with a lot of it is it's very hard to explain to the ordinary punters out there that the real problem is that the financial system is still shot to pieces. It's not fixed. And there's very likely going to be a round two of financial crisis.
Well,
and you can't really talk about that, because people don't want to talk about it. They want to hear about what's your solution to our various little problems we've got now, and say, well, the real problem is going to be there's going to be another meltdown, and then we're going to have to deal with that.
Well, I know I'm interested to tease this out. We've got time. Let's look, for instance, at Carillion, who was a gargantuan company that largely won government contracts. Capita is another one who have announced a profit warning this week. This is outsourcing of what the apparatus of state used to do, set up under private finance initiatives, which was another Blairite project to get schools built, to get prisons built, to get hospitals done and all of this sort of stuff, using cheap money, which had been made available by the deregulation of the financial services sector. And the whole thing is gone to head in a hell in a
Hand. Yeah, well, I mean, it was a way of making sure it wasn't on the official books. And PFI means that it's not borrowed by the government, it's borrowed by a third party, so it doesn't go on as government borrowing. But it's the most inefficient way to fund infrastructure spending, because it's much cheaper for a national government than even the local government to borrow money and spend it on what it wants. Mm-hmm. And things like big infrastructure projects, you obviously are going to end up with, to a large extent, big private companies doing it. But there's no reason why Carillion should have been running things like school meals and so on. That's bonkers, because all of that stuff now is up, put in a position of we don't know what's happening with it. And they bought into the idea that this was the modern way to do things. And it was PFI started under the Tory government. It should have been killed off immediately, but it wasn't. And we're now, of course, years later, stuck with all of these deals where even if you try and withdraw from the deal, you've then got to pay a huge penalty.
When you say it started off under the Tory government, are we talking about John Major's Tory government?
Yeah, they were the ones who first brought in PFI.
Okay, but it accelerated dramatically during the Blair years.
Well, one of the problems is that these kind of policies like PFI are decided at a much higher level of things like, the Bilderberg meeting or whatever. This is the way we're going to do it. And it doesn't matter who the government is. This is how we're going to do it. The same thing happened in New Zealand, where the Labour Party got elected in the early 1980s and immediately carried out a crash privatisation programme, which was already on the drawing board drawn up in the United States. And that is the reality, is that national governments get told what to do, and they're actually just a transmission belt for this much bigger struggle that's going on at a higher level. And of course, they had 3 terms in power, the Labour Party, and they could have chipped away and pushed back against this, but they didn't. And that's why, ultimately, of course, there's been this stand-up fist fight inside the Labour Party for a change of direction and a change of policy.
Do you think they didn't because Gordon Brown felt obligated to empty the nation's gold reserves to fund Tony Blair's war in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, both Blair and Brown went over, and this is the sort of thing that Marvin Rees did as well, went and did further degrees and so on over in the US. And the same thing happened with people who ended up in power in New Zealand. And they basically get suborned. They go over there to convince our masters on the other side of the pond that we're a safe pair of hands. They convince Rupert Murdoch supported Blair for years, and that's all on the basis that you're going to do it this way, and that's what modern Labourism looks like. And of course, that's been proved now to be completely wrong, but it takes a while for the reality to sink in, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does present one with a rather bleak voting palette on election day, doesn't it?
Well, it does, because I think obviously what people are hoping for, if there is a Labour government or Labour-led government soon, is, fundamental. Things like renationalisation of utilities and railways, there's overwhelming public support for that. And it's not as if it's some crazy scheme. This is how we used to do it, and it worked reasonably well for many decades. So, the older generation can easily see why can't we just do it like that? I mean, you've still got to nationalise water industry, for example, in Scotland, and so on. Whereas what we've got here with Wessex Water and Bristol Water is just completely rip-off private sector nonsense.
Okay, so what's the solution? How does one legally, legitimately go about renationalising essential public services and transport?
Well, one of the obvious way to do it is you tighten the regulations to such an extent that it's impossible for private companies to make a profit at it, and then you buy it off them and they give it to you for a price which is, because they want to get rid of it. Okay. And that's how you do it. But, and so you don't even have to spend a lot of money on it. With net rail franchising, it comes up every few years to be re-franchised, and you just take it off them at that point without changing, without buying them out. There's no reason why you should buy them out. Why should we buy out Carillion if it's bankrupt?
Well,
there's no reason to give them a penny, is there?
Network Rail is still an apparatus of state.
Well, it became one because they had to take it back because the practicalities forced the state. If there's a collapse of Southern Cross, the private care homes looking after people, then the state has to step in and sort it out. And if the state's going to step in and sort it out, you might as well have the state running it in the first place, wouldn't you?
Some of the Red Tops today ran some delightful stories about the invoicing from Boots the Chemist to the NHS. Obviously, because they're Red Tops, they had some staggering examples of a £2 skin cream, which was being billed back to the NHS as part of a prescription for £1,600. That's inflationary markup of 8,000%. And the government is signing off on this. The NHS is signing off on this.
Well, I mean, there's a case for the nationalisation of the pharmaceuticals industry, and it's been pushed in international trade negotiations by places like Bangladesh and so on, saying, well, we want to produce our own generic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the cost of the NHS is, healthcare companies and private pharmaceutical companies padding their own bottom line by selling stuff to the NHS. The logical thing to do is just take it over and produce at cost, isn't it? But of course, that sort of thinking has been taboo for a generation. But if we do have another serious economic crisis, and I'm afraid we're going to have one, then suddenly all these things aren't taboo anymore. We might be actually moving back to doing things that we used to do 40, 50 years ago, which will turn out to be quite sensible things to do.
Tell me what is going to prompt the next serious financial crisis.
It's not quite clear. But if you look at the stock markets around the world now, they've been wobbling this week, but they're actually at the highest levels they've ever been on the back of Trump's tax cuts in the US, he's basically saying we're going to spend loads more on military expenditure, as if they didn't spend enough. They spend more than the rest of the world combined. But they're also going to cut taxes for the wealthy. And, of course, the wealthy are thinking, yippee, we're going to invest that in the stock market, and the stock market's gone up through the roof. But, I mean, the fact is that when he was standing for election, Trump said that's a bubble. And it was a bubble, it is a bubble, and it's going to burst. And when it bursts, we'll all know about it.
Okay. Do you think, the rest of the Western world is right to try and ape and pursue the American model of outsourcing everything, extremely long hours? I mean, if you look at societal America of today, there's 2 million people in jail. There's the death sentence in the majority of the states. They're legalizing marijuana growing and consumption in a number of the other states. There are innumerable mass killings regularly. It's not a very loving, community-spirited sort of place.
No.
Should Britain be trying to achieve that?
No, we shouldn't. And if people who want to pursue the American model, like Liam Fox, for example, with his own department,
Dr. Liam,
if you want to live like the United States, you'll have to live like the United States. But of course, in the United States, it's a bigger place. If you're wealthy in Los Angeles, you don't have to live anywhere near poor people. They're 20 kilometers away. But if we really do have a gun culture developing in Britain, like in the United States, they're going to be shooting on your front lawn, because it's a small country. Mm-hmm. You're going to run into these people.
Well, exactly. We're seeing evidence of that already. Okay, we're going to take another piece of music and then we'll come back. And we have been discussing America briefly. We'll talk about the Donald's State of the Union address. And then we will have to talk about some slightly more cerebral issues. Tony Gosling is on his holidays this week. That's why I, Billy Quain, am sitting in his hot seat hosting Affairs. We're going to talk about Brexit and Mrs. May's trip to China. We could also talk about Mayor Marvin Rees's trip to China and his upcoming trip to New York and his previous trip to Malaysia. My, my, he really is spreading the Bristol message far and wide. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Red Right Hand. We've been talking rather red right handy stuff today on the show because there's been a lot of talk about Labour and Red and all things socialist, which they don't appear to be doing. We'll come back to that presently because I do want to talk to old Labour economist Martin Summers a little bit about how we can affect actual positive change locally between now and 2020, which is when the current sitting Bristol City Council are up for renewal. We haven't got any democratic right to remove them until 2020. Lucky us. But Martin was saying, as we were listening to Nick Cave, because we were teeing up our next conversation point, we're going to be discussing Donald Trump and his State of the Union address. Martin said people with no people skills don't realise they have no people skills. And I think you've just summed Donald Trump up beautifully, Martin.
Yes.
You listen to a State of the Union. What state is the Union of the United States in these days?
Well, there's an open warfare, isn't there, between the Trump faction and those that don't want him in there. The electoral college system in the US means that Trump, in fact, didn't win the majority of the votes in the election, but he wins because he won the majority of the states. And that creates a fundamental problem of legitimacy. So, you know, the people who are opposed to him, Hillary Clinton being the obvious one, are saying, well, he didn't even win a majority of the votes, but there he is.
Okay.
But that's the US system for you.
Could I just clarify this now? You are telling me that the beacon of worldwide democracy, the United States, has an incumbent president
who didn't win the majority of the votes.
Exactly.
Well, that happens quite regularly in the US. The same thing happened with George W. Bush when he was first elected. And it's because of the electoral system. It's an electoral college, so all of the votes of each individual state get given to one candidate or the other. It's not on an individual voter basis. And therefore, if you can win the big states, you get all of the votes for those states, and therefore you can win even though you've got less votes than the other people. And it's because of it's a federal system, supposedly.
Yeah.
But of course, it creates problems when you've got a democracy that doesn't actually have the person who won the most votes running the show, and
well,
they've got total power.
Do, am I going to sound foolish to mention that this is idiotic?
Well, it is, but changing the US system is very difficult because it's a written constitution from the 18th century, and it's treated as a kind of sacred document. So to try and change, the changes in electoral systems that were carried out in Western Europe, for example, at the end of the Second World War to level the playing field and give everybody a fair go, it's very difficult to do that in the US. It's basically an oligarchic system, and it was designed deliberately. In the Senate, you've got two senators for each state, and that, so California only gets two senators, the same as Vermont with a much lower population. And again, that's deliberately designed by the original designers of the US Constitution to give a conservative bias, to make sure that landed property wouldn't be threatened and so on. So it's not in fact a full democratic system. It's an oligarchic system with democratic features.
So why on earth is Britain standing shoulder to shoulder with the export of this kind of democracy down the barrel of a gun to places in North Africa and the Middle East?
Well, we don't have a fully democratic system either. You know, we've got the House of Lords, we've got first past the post, which means that, if you actually added up the DUP's votes and the Tory votes, they're not actually 50% plus one. And in other European countries, they wouldn't be the government. But what happens is people get used to running things the way they run it. That's the way we run it, and that's... But this, as we go forward and democracy around the world becomes something that everybody aspires to, the fact that you haven't actually got a properly democratic setup starts to matter a lot. I mean, for the negotiations over Brexit, for example, the Irish government, for whatever its faults, is representative of the people's views. It's not clear that May does represent, the plurality of views.
Well, indeed. But let's be honest. I mean, nobody elected Theresa May to be the leader of the government. She was the least worst candidate to replace David Cameron.
Well, she ended up there. And, of course, we've got this... this new continuity act, which is brought in by the coalition, that you don't necessarily have to have a general election if she falls. So if she falls as a result of rowing with the anti-Brexit Tories, we wouldn't necessarily get a general election. What happens under the new rules has been set up is that the Queen would have to call Corbyn to the palace to see if he could form an alternative coalition. And in fact, the DUP have voted with the Labour Party on various policies over the last since the election on social issues. And, it's possible that the DUP could switch sides and you just have Corbyn in number 10 without an election backed by the DUP. I'm not saying it's going to happen.
Oh, it's highly likely that it will happen.
But it's possible.
Mercurial, I think you Ulster Unionists are.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, and that's what you'd do if you were them. You play both sides against the middle to maximise what you're going for.
To be honest, I wouldn't be one of them anyway. But anyway.
Well, nor would I.
Actually, you've brought Northern Ireland up now. We probably ought to talk about it. I was going to talk about Theresa May in China, and we will get to that because she didn't appear as though she enjoyed herself very much. No. And I didn't hear an awful lot from Xi Jinping. About Britain, or indeed about the fact that she was there.
Well, like you can imagine from the Chinese point of view, the Theresa May turning up is not really the biggest and most exciting thing that's going on. They've got other fish to fry, other people they'd rather be talking to. It's a relatively minor visit compared to some other more important countries. I mean, Germany, for example, does a lot of trade with China. They massive exports surplus with the Chinese. They sell them lots of machine tools and so on. We really don't do much business with them at all. So there's not really much point. It's not really a big priority for them, is it?
Well, I hate to say, Britain kind of blotted their copybook with China in the 1850s with the two opium
wars. There's a history, isn't there?
And I'm not certain that the majority of China has forgiven them for that.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, if the Chinese Communist Party is obviously, again, it's an authoritarian oligarchic setup. But if, insofar as you can tell from looking at social media and so on, there is quite a strong nationalist sentiment in China. And, of course, it certainly remembers Britain's role in the past basically exploiting and messing the place up.
Yeah.
And we may have forgotten about it, but they haven't.
Well, perfectly justified. Incidentally, this is an opportune moment to plug the Saturday edition, which is my regular arts show that I'm hosting tomorrow morning. There are two plays playing in Bristol this week, which deal very specifically with that subject. There's an adaptation by Simon Dormody of E.M. Forster's A Passage to India, which I saw during the week. It's fantastic, but there is significant political bite behind the work. It's about India as it was, the subcontinent as it was during the British Raj, at the point when sectarianism and religious conflict between Hindus and Muslims, as well as the rising call for independence, were percolating to the surface. And that goes hand in glove with Joe Seelman Deva's play Labels, about being a first generation half Indian Britain. That's playing at the Wardrobe Theatre. If we look back, because I mentioned the 1850s then, if we look back through Britain's glorious colonial history and their get out, they've left chaos around the world. Look at Kashmir, look at Syria, look at Iraq, look at most of Africa, look at Northern Ireland. They haven't been elegant and constructive with any of their colonial departures, have they?
Well, no, and it's an ongoing thing that we need to confront, isn't it? I mean, one of the worst episodes of British colonialism was in Kenya. There's a book by Caroline Elkins, who's a US academic, and she basically shows in the book that up to 250,000 people were tortured to death by British forces in Kenya during the emergency. Britain has admitted that 11,000 people died, but she's suggesting it's more in the 250,000 area, and there were over 1.5 million Kikuyu in these death camps, as they were, during that era. And of course there were less political prisoners in Stalin's Russia than were dying under the hot sun in Kenya. And of course one of the things they used to do an awful lot of was electrocutions, castrations. So these guys came not long ago and managed to sue for compensation for being castrated by British forces in these camps. And this was all these years ago. And of course, we walk away and say, well, you know, we at least we gave you your independence. But it was a pretty bloody process.
Well, you say all these years ago. An awful lot of this was happening in the 60s and 70s.
Well, this is the 1950s we're talking about now. But yeah. The people involved are definitely still around
this
and still drawing pensions.
This is less than two generations ago history.
Yeah.
Do you think Britain has... there's a temerity, there's a gall to their approach to international relations?
Well, there is, yes. There is. There's an arrogance that's traditional in this country in relation to foreigners in general. And, you know, I think also there are two sides to the British character, as you know. And, you know, we've got to be absolutely honest about the negative aspects and also the fact that we walked away. I mean, the Americans could learn a lot from the British who walked away from their empire. The Americans are going to have to do exactly the same thing, but they're nowhere near ready to do it yet.
Well, there's significant issues going on because of the hurricanes, actually, in some of the Caribbean independents of the United States. There's one in particular.
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, thank you. I was going to say Costa Rica. It's not Costa Rica, it's Puerto Rico. And not only has there been appreciable brain drain with all of the educated Puerto Ricans moving to the States to seek a better life there. The infrastructure has gone to the dogs since the hurricanes over the winter, in the autumn. And the Donald is saying, yeah, you won't get an ounce of help from us, despite the fact that they all carry US passports.
Yeah, well, they're not allowed to vote in presidential elections and so on. Again, there's all of these kind of anomalies that people forget about how the US works, you know. And the other thing, of course, is that Puerto Rico is bankrupt. We were talking earlier about what might cause a crash. Well, Puerto Rico is sufficiently important to the US that their debt could be the trigger for a US crash, which would then cause a crash for everybody else. Mm-hmm. But there's so many possibilities of crashes. It's not just in the US. It could happen because of anything, really.
Well, I struggle to reconcile the talk from Dr. Liam and David Davis and Theresa May and a whole bunch of these people who are busy thrusting Britain back into international trade relations and discussions, because Britain doesn't manufacture an awful lot anymore, and it still, protects a number of tax havens around the world, which is getting right up the nose of an awful lot of sovereign states.
Well, it is, yeah. And, of course, the US is quite a tax haven as well. Nevada is shaping up as a big tax haven. So a lot of the politics around tax havens is that the US is pressuring other people to close their tax havens, and they're saying, bring it all over here because we'll look after it for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid this kind of corporate... theft, really. The US is the poster child for this, and Britain is their sidekick. It's like Dastardly and Muttley, and the rest of the world's getting pretty fed up with it, as you pointed out.
Well, it seems to be never ending. There is a greater tax burden on everybody, which is being less well rewarded consistently with good quality public service of any kind, not just healthcare, not just education, not just social care.
Yeah, but I mean, the fundamental of that is bailing out the financial services sector in 2008, 10 years ago this year. I mean, the textbook says, the Milton Friedman textbook, the free market textbook, is you let the banks go down, just let them go. Mm-hmm. We didn't.
Iceland
but
did.
Of course, well, they did, but what Iceland did is they compensated people of Icelandic descent, and Icelandic citizens were compensated for any losses that they might have from the bank, but foreigners were not. And in actual fact, lots of Brits, including local authorities and individuals, had their money in Landsbanki and Icesave, and the Icelanders just took the view that was for the British government to compensate those people, and so that was just added to the British national debt. And if you remember, at one stage Brown was the Prime Minister, and he was talking about restarting the Cod War with the Icelanders to make them accept the debts, you know, which British citizens lost their money. But they didn't lose their money because the British government stepped in and bailed them out. Now, of course, if you're Iceland, you've only got 200, you know, less than the population of Bristol living in Iceland, you can get away with passing your debt on to somebody else, and they just, you know, at that point they have to take it. But I mean, that's you know, I think the Icelanders did a good job there. It's perfectly reasonable for them to say that we're not going to compensate foreigners, but it doesn't. It's not a general solution.
Well, there was a little bit of accountability, at least.
Oh, yes. Well, you can imagine, as in a country that small, people, everybody knows the people concerned, and they're pretty fed up that they've... I mean, Landsbank in Icesave used to be publicly owned banks, and they were only privatised in 2004. And then basically used to take people's money, keep it, and then give it to them when they wanted it. That's all they did. And then they said, no, we got to... But, you know, once they were privatised, they soon had assets far greater than the actual GNP of Iceland. Completely bonkers. But that was that era.
OK, we've talked around the issue. James Brokenshire is gone off on sick leave. Northern Ireland, Stormont, is still without a representative assembly, despite all of the local MLPs being paid a salary to represent their constituents.
Well, I believe that the Tories have appointed somebody else to be Northern Ireland Minister, haven't they? Not Brokenshire, rather unfortunate name in the circumstances.
Well, and I wish him a speedy recovery.
I think he's got his family reasons or whatever he gave us.
No, yeah, his health was it, reasons.
I don't know, somebody else, I can't remember who is now in charge of it, but they're supposed to be talking about trying to put together an agreement for an assembly, but nothing much has happened about it. I thought they were going to do it this week, but it's nothing
at all. And we should also point out that in light of pay equality and women's rights to the top positions, Arlene Foster is leading the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, who are currently in it's not coalition. What's the agreement they've got with the Tory government?
It's something in supply. Yes, something in supply.
Confidence in supply agreement with Theresa May's Conservative Party, and they are just about a majority government here in the UK. And of course, you have a young woman called Karen O'Neill, I think. It's something O'Neill, running Sinn Féin, which is the largest nationalist party at the Northern Ireland Assembly. And it was Michelle O'Neill, thank you. It was indeed Sinn Féin who walked out of the previous Stormont Assembly in protest at a botched green energy scheme, which was steamrolled through Congress by Arlene Foster, the very Arlene Foster. This is a mess, Martin.
It is, but I think Sinn Féin, I mean, I don't know their thinking, but I think if they are part of a Stormont Assembly, then they have to implement the policy of the national government in Britain, which is to carry through cuts. Although, of course, the DUP were promised an extra £1 billion if they would prop up the government.
Yeah, where's that gone?
Well, they haven't had it yet.
Oh, interesting. Will they not get it until Sinn Féin go back into the room?
Well, no. I mean, they could be playing hardball with them. You're not going to get it unless they... But, of course, they've already had an important influence because of the whole thing of the first stage of the Brexit process about not having a hard Irish border, and then the DUP insisting that they were not going to get a separate arrangements for the six counties as opposed to the whole of the rest of the UK. I mean, you could envisage a situation where, you know, the six counties remain in the customs union, the single market, or even in the European Union, since that's what people voted for in Northern Ireland. But
the minute you do that, because Scotland also voted to remain.
Well, indeed. But then these raise questions, fundamental questions, about the way you run the electoral systems and what your mandates actually are. And I think this is what Brexit is bringing home, is that we've got a rickety system. We haven't got a written constitution. It's not clear who's, you know, the argument in favour of doing it this way as opposed to... And in any case, the agreement made with the other European Union countries, and particularly with Dublin leading, is that there's not going to be a hard border, which means that you've got to have some kind of agreement about the customs union or single market. And that's already been agreed. But, of course, it's not been agreed by the Tory right wing. and they're trying to fudge it. But the DUP also said, I mean, I can't quite understand the DUP's position, but as far as I understand it, they're saying they want the same deal as the rest of the UK. They don't want the same deal as the rest of the UK on abortion rights. They don't want the same deal as the rest of the UK on various things, but on this they want to have the same deal as the rest of the UK. But that, of course, means that there's got to be, we've got to stay in the customs union at least. But of course, Liam Fox has already said today, we're not going to stay in the customs union. Well, that's complete defiance of what's already been agreed with the EU27. This is turning into a, you know, the struggle in Northern Ireland to set up a Stormont Assembly is being subsumed into this wider question of what Britain's relationship with Europe, with Ireland, its internal politics is about. It's basically very interesting, mm-hmm. but it's a bit of a mess.
There was a fun headline that grabbed my attention today from the Cork Examiner, which is the broadsheet newspaper in my hometown of Cork City, which is down on the very south coast of Ireland, for people who didn't get the British Isles geography as part of their British education curriculum. And they apparently, there has been an avalanche of unionists applying for Republic of Ireland passports, so they don't have to queue up in EU airports with a British passport to get across borders.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because what clearly happened is in the referendum in Northern Ireland was a substantial chunk of loyalists. Unionist opinion saw that staying inside the European Union was in their interests. It's a common sense thing, isn't it? I mean, Arlene Foster's from South Armagh. Those people do loads of business across the border all the time. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for us not to have a border there. And in many ways, that was quite a sense. I mean, of course, the DUP itself campaigned for Brexit, and money was channeled through the DUP, because they don't have to count for it in the same way as other British political parties, for general campaigning for Brexit. But the majority in Northern Ireland did not vote for Brexit, and that raises questions, doesn't it?
Well, it's a mess, frankly, but it's been a mess for 400 years.
Yeah, that's right. So it's going to carry on being a mess. But at least the positives, I mean, we've obviously discussed this in the past. The positives is, I don't think there's any danger whatsoever that people are going to go back to blowing things up and killing each other. I think that's done and dusted.
Well, let's hope. There has been a little bit more kind of terrorism-related news this week coming out of Northern Ireland. There was a significant furore when a loyalist informant who has been incriminated in over 200 crimes ranging from murder to extortion to miscellaneous terrorist offences has had his sentence commuted because he's agreed to turn prosecution witness to point the finger at some of his colleagues from the bad old days. Mm. That can't be justice being served.
No, well, I think ultimately the what Sinn Féin have been pushing for all along, and I tend to agree, is you're going to have something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where everybody comes forward and says what they did, on the understanding that we're not necessarily going to punish people, we just need to get to the bottom of it. This is a halfway house where people are being punished, but they're not being punished as they should be, on the basis that they're cooperating with the authorities, etc. But of course, the underlying issue here is the cooperation between the security forces and the loyalist paramilitaries. Brigadier Gordon Curry used to run the Force Research Unit and so on. Ultimately, these kind of people either should go in the dock or they should be forced to testify about what went on. And most people in Britain are unaware that the security forces are implicated in many murders in Northern Ireland, because they are.
Well, it's not just the boots on the ground. It actually runs to quite senior level, a lot of this.
Oh, yes.
One of the interesting immediate effects of this character turning state's evidence is that Stakeknife has been arrested this week.
Yep.
A renowned mole who has consistently denied any involvement or activity with one side or the other. And, Martin, I'm back next week, so I'm going to bet you one whole British sterling pound that there will be at least half a dozen related murders in Northern Ireland this weekend.
Well, what do you think? There's going to be a load of murders this weekend.
There is going to be some bloodletting or some shutting upping.
Maybe. I think. I doubt that, Billy.
I think.
Well, let's see.
People.
Everybody's known who Steak Knife is for years now. It's not as if it's a secret. I think the person that caused most grief on the Republican side was Donaldson when he was outed as a British agent, because he was top. He was at the top table mm-hmm. in the Republican movement. But I think the fact is that the people have moved on. I mean, that kind of way of doing business is over.
Well, you say that. We've moved on. Britain has moved on. But the two factions in Northern Ireland are still as entrenched as they ever were.
Well, they are, but they've also, through fighting each other and talking to each other, which is what fighting involves, there's gradually been an understanding about how to resolve these kind of issues. It's still messy. I mean, you saw that we didn't mention what she said, McElvoy, the Sinn Féin MP, with his stupid
genius
King's bread on his head.
Genius.
Well, he's had to resign. There'll have to be a by-election, I presume, and his position was untenable.
Well, one would hope so. Fool. But that's the other thing, of course. A lot of the people who are actually in decision-making positions are there on, I don't know, a family link or strength of emotion or something. They're not the best qualified people to do these things.
No, but I mean, as you know. You know, who you know and connections and so on mean an awful lot in a small face-to-face society. I mean, this guy presumably was representing himself. What he was doing was making the sort of joke which was regarded as sort of black humour during the Troubles. But of course, it just came across, I mean, as really totally inappropriate in the new circumstances.
And idiotic. Idiotic. Yes. Anyway, on that happy note, we're going to leave it there for this week. Thank you, Martin. It's been fun. We've had a good ding-dong, I think. Councillor Mark Wright was with us for the first hour. Next week, I'm hoping to have Paul O'Rourke, who's the Green Councillor for Clifton, in talking about libraries. And I've also approached Labour Councillor Mark Bradshaw, who is the Councillor for Bedminster. And I would like to pick over his brains on mayoral candidacy and all things south of the river. Martin is back again next week. Thank you very much. I'm back 10 o'clock tomorrow morning with the Saturday edition. Do tune in for that. It's a packed show with Gail Bowen-Huggett. And next up, we have got Leila Arabia with, what's his name, Martin? I've forgotten his name.
Mohammed.
Mohammed Makawi is here after the news.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.